Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Marcus Casey continues our series of talks on the lives of the Karmapas. Today, we explore the power of practice to subdue the ego and overcome adversity through the example of the second Karmapa, Karmapakshi. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So thanks for coming today. My name is Marcus Casey. I'm a volunteer meditation instructor, and when our lamas are away, she's asked some of us to fill in. Lama Kathy, Lama Tom have asked us to go through a book study. And the book study we're doing right now, we're actually doing a couple books simultaneously and hopping back and forth between them. Today is we're going to be looking at the history of the Karmapas again. And we're going to be talking about the second Karmapa, Karmapakshi. So in previous talks, we've talked about how the lineage started with the Indian yogis and then was passed down from Talopa to Naropa to Marpa, who was a Tibetan who made several arduous journeys to India and then translated the teachings into Tibetan. And Marpa passed them down to his disciple Milarepa, who was known as a great yogi and meditator, one of the most beloved figures in Tibetan history. And then Milarepa's primary student was Gampopa, and Gampopa was notable because he had received the classical training in philosophies in the monasteries, things like that. And then he received this yogic lineage of Mahamudra from his teacher Milarepa. Milarepa. And he brought the two together into the lineage of teachings that we have today. And then Gampopa's student was Dusum Kimpa, who realized the nature of the mind and before he died gave a last testament. And this last testament contained predictions about his own rebirth and where he would be reborn. And then started the entire system of naming the reincarnation of some of these advanced masters, naming their own reincarnation or reincarnating and being discovered. Sets the stage for what we're going to be talking about today, which is his successor, his reincarnation, Karmapakshi. So this book contains a set of spiritual biographies, and I love the balance they've struck with these spiritual biographies. There's an emphasis on the biographical information that you would expect, where they were born, and they traveled here, and they started this monastery, and things like that. But they also take great care to emphasize the spirituality and many of the things that inspire us. And this one is just fascinating. I think you're going to find it fascinating. One little teaser I'll give you is there are people in this week's story that you studied about in school. So just a little teaser. You'll recognize it when we get there. One for sure. One you may have studied about in English class. The other one I'm sure you studied about in history. So we'll get to that. We traditionally say the four-line refuge prayer at the beginning of our talks. And I know it's in Tibetan, and some of you know it, and some of you don't. If you don't, feel free to just listen and make the aspiration that you will awaken and help others to awaken. When we chant this, we're chanting about our commitment to take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, who is the goal or what we aspire to, the Dharma, which is the path, and the Sangha, or the guides and companions on the path. We'll chant the refuge prayer three times. Sangje chudang tsoki cho nam la jang chu bardu dai ni gyab su chi dagi jin so ki pe su nam gi dro la pen chir sangje dru par sho Sangje chudang tsoki cho nam la jang chu bardu dai ni kyab su chi dagi jin so ki pe su nam ki dro la pen chir sangje dru par sho Sangje chudang tsoki cho nam la jang chu bardu dang ni kyab su chi dagi jin so ki pe su nam gi dro la pen chir sangje dru par sho Okay, so a little context. Karmapakshi, the second Karmapa, was born in eastern Tibet at the beginning of the 13th century in the year 1204. He was born into a family descended from a famous Tibetan king who lived in the 8th century. His parents were both yogis, and Karmapakshi was their youngest child. There were signs that the Karmapa would be exceptional that happened just before his conception, while he was in the womb, and at the time of his birth. So just before his conception, his mother dreamt of a sun comprised of light emanating from her heart, with rays illuminating the entire world. The pregnancy was without any difficulty, and one could hear the famous mantra Om Mani Padme Hum coming from the womb. At the moment of his birth, numerous auspicious signs appeared, indicating that the child would have an exceptional destiny. He was given the name Chudzin, which means holder of the doctrine, and he was able to perfectly read and write the sacred texts at barely 6 years old. Because his parents were convinced that he had great spiritual qualities, they turned him over to a great master, and it actually happened to be a student of the teacher that the first Karmapa had given his last testament to. In other words, the first Karmapa passed along the lineage of teachings to a holder until he was reborn, and then gave his predictions for where he would be reborn. A student of that holder happened to be the person that the parents turned this child over to and asked this teacher to teach their child. And the teacher quickly realized that this young student was blessed by the Dakinis, in his words. And he had a vision in which the first Karmapa and other Kagyu Lamas surrounded the child's home. And sometime later, he had another vision in which the first Karmapa announced to him that this was his reincarnation. So when Chudzin was 11, he was officially recognized as a tulku, or the reincarnation of the first Karmapa. And as I mentioned before, this is the start in Tibet of that entire system, which is very common today. We have more than just His Holiness the Karmapa, the current one is the 17th. We have other teachers in our lineage, which are tulkus, or reincarnations of previous masters. Similarly, the Dalai Lama is now the 14th Dalai Lama, the current Dalai Lama. But that whole system started back in the 12th and 13th century with the death and rebirth of the Karmapa. So at 11, he was ordained as a novice and was given the title Chokyi Lama, Master of the Dharma. So once he was recognized, Karmapakshi received from his master the direct teachings on the nature of the mind. Keep in mind, he was age 11 at this point. He was very studious, and he rapidly acquired profound knowledge of the different texts. If you put yourself in his shoes, at age 11, he knew that these teachings he was receiving, he would have to one day also teach. And those close to him were very impressed by how quickly he picked up the teachings and the practices. I know the question is often asked, when a master like this reincarnates, do they come in with all that same knowledge, that same realization? How does that work? And the answer I've heard is that no, they don't actually have that realization from birth, but once they start the practice, once they're exposed to the teachings, they pick it up really quickly because there are just no karmic barriers to realizing the teachings. So, and that seems to be what's going on here and what's reported here. So Karmapakshi's master wanted him to be affiliated with a lineage and to receive the traditional initiations, reading transmissions, and written or oral instructions. And over the following 11 years, he received numerous transmissions of the Karmakagyu lineage, such as Mahamudra and the six yogas of Naropa. Now, the six yogas of Naropa are specific teachings that really you only... I think it's most common or traditionally you only learn those if you go on three-year retreat. So it's not something that any of the non-lamas around here have come in contact with. I don't even know what all six of them are. But one of them specifically I know is the development of inner heat called tummo, in which you are able to raise your body temperature and keep it steady even in cold temperatures. And it was said that that Karmapakshi could actually melt the snow around him at quite a distance just from generating tummo, or this inner heat. And again, there are other practices too that have to do with working with the inner energies and winds and things like that, although those are mostly just practiced in retreat settings or taught in retreat settings. It was said that Karmapakshi very early manifested great compassion for all sentient beings and asked his following to protect animals. He composed teachings specifically on the six-syllable mantra of compassion, Om Mani Padme Hum. And it was said that just reading the treatises that he wrote on the mantra, even without faith in their content, ensured a karmic link with him and favored spiritual maturation. When he was 22, he took the vows of a fully ordained monk. And during this time in Tibet, there was a lot of trouble and conflict. And because of his qualities and charisma, Karmapakshi was often called on to aid in the peaceful resolution of these conflicts. And this continued throughout his life in his travels. Wherever he went, he would often use diplomacy to resolve conflict in different areas. It was said that Karmapakshi had achieved perfect control over elemental energy and spontaneously created harmony in the immediate environment. So, fascinating. And you'll see that as we keep going. Karmapakshi had a vision of Mahakala Bernakchen. Now, Mahakala is the principal protector of the Karmakagyu lineage. And when we were in our old building, and I'm sure we'll be back to that when we're in our new building, we had three different shrines. We had the main shrine, and then the one over to this side was a Mahakala shrine. And we also do the Mahakala practice. Is it once a month? Do we still do that? Once a month? Third Sunday. Okay, there's your advertisement. So, and they do it at our home monastery, I believe, daily. So Karmapakshi had this vision of Mahakala prompting him to construct a monastery. And building a monastery is a very arduous and drawn-out task. But at that time, Tibetan society was very much oriented around its religious institutions. It's kind of interesting to me when you look at a society like Tibet was in those days, and still is to some degree. There was a very different role for those who were not monks and nuns. Obviously, they had a lot of monks and nuns. They had a lot of great monasteries and things like that. So many children, even starting as young as five, would start in the monasteries. But for the laity, they really saw their role as supporting these monks and nuns and the monasteries. So they would attend teachings, they would often do practices, but it was a primary part of their role in society to support these monasteries. I kind of think about the way we do it here, where we, we're Westerners. We want the latest and we want the greatest thing ever, right? So we show up, give me all the teachings, and, you know, if there's a $5 suggested donation, then we give the $5 suggested donation. But these things are more on my mind because we've been working on fundraising for several years now, nonstop. So one day we'll get back in our building. But the Karmapa's greatest wish was to establish monastic communities with the utmost respect for the Vinaya, or the monastic code established by the Buddha. So I mentioned that that many children would come as young as the age of five. So, but they would not take the full vows of monks and nuns. There were many levels of vows that could be taken. When they started at age five, actually the vows they took were the four, the five lay precepts, which are divided into two sets. The four main ones are don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, and no sexual misconduct. And then the fifth one was to protect your mind so that you could be able to keep the other four, and that was to not use any mind-altering substances or no alcohol, basically. So when the children would show up to the monastery really young, they would take those first vows. And then the next set would traditionally be taken around the age of 14, although they could be taken earlier, and Karmapakshi took them at 11. These were the novice vows, so they would have added more vows to the novice vows. And then when they were ready, usually around the age of 20, they would take the full vows. The full vows, there are hundreds of vows they actually take, so lots of different things that they need to observe. And the monks and nuns, actually, by breaking these, could be expelled from the Sangha and from their monastery. But we got something going on up there, don't we? Doesn't sound good, does it? And so these are generally taken for life, but it is possible to, if the monk or nun wants to return to lay life, they can give back their vows. And in our tradition, you'll know whether a lama is a monastic as well by whether or not they have the white shawl. This is something actually pretty new in the last few years. Kenpo Garja Rinpoche asked all of the non-monastic lamas to wear the white shawl. So that's why Lama Kathy switched to wearing the white shawl. And then if they aren't wearing the white shawl, you'll know they're both a lama and a monastic. Or you can be a monastic without being a lama, which means you're a monk or nun, but you haven't taken a three-year retreat. So, yes?
What's the significance of the white shawl just beyond just being that signifier?
As far as I know, it's just that. That's all I know. And I mean, Lama Kathy, really, it's been in the last 2 years, I think, that she started wearing the white shawl. It was all the wine-colored robes before that. So that's a pretty new thing in our tradition. So Karmapakshi traveled to a monastery founded by the first Karmapa and undertook its restoration. And this is a big job that the heads of lineages take on, is to keep up the monasteries. Monasteries are indispensable for the carrying on of the lineage. So the Karmapa would travel all over Tibet to give teachings and initiation and things like that, but also to restore or construct their monastic infrastructure. And somewhere, I've got some numbers here. It was said that Karmapakshi throughout his lifetime actually, I may have to wait till I get there, but something like he either refurbished or started 8,000 monasteries in Tibet. Just an astounding amount of work for one lifetime. So Karmapakshi actually stated that all those who were bound to him, either negatively or positively, would more quickly gain realization and escape the cycle of existence. Now, I know in some of our practices, we make aspirations like that. We make aspirations that may all those I come in contact with, whether in a negative or a positive context, may I be of benefit to them, and may one day they come to enlightenment. So we make aspirations like this. Karmapakshi actually had that realization and was able to say with confidence that actually is the way it worked with him. So everyone here listening, you have a karmic connection to Karmapakshi just by nature of being here today, but also as being part of this lineage. It is still a living lineage that has passed down from that time to now. It was said that as Karmapakshi traveled, people would commonly see Mahakala and other deities in the company that was traveling with him. And it was not unusual for those who followed him to perceive him as haloed with an aura, or to see multiple rainbows unfurled as he passed as signs of his realization. So this was a very realized being. So in addition to overseeing Tsurpu Monastery, the monastery that was established by the first Karmapa, he also visited the monastery that Gampopa established. And there he had a vision of Gampopa prophesying that the Karmakagyu lineage would spread its blessing throughout the world. And of course, we and our center are living proof of that here in Columbus, Ohio. In another vision, he saw a Vajrayogini who instructed him to widely spread the six-syllable mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Now, that mantra existed before that. It was part of the Chinrezig practice, and it was the Chinrezig compassion mantra. But it was not as central to Tibetan practice before that as it was after that. So actually Karmapakshi is the one responsible for that. And I already mentioned he wrote many treatises on this and stuff like that, but his traveling camp, as they traveled across Tibet, would chant this. The whole company would chant this together as they traveled. And from this time on, it became a central part of Tibetan culture and practice. It's said that children in Tibet learn this mantra before they learn their own names, before they learn to say, to talk at all. This is really the first thing they learn to say because they hear it so much. And when I was reading about this, I thought about Khenpo Karta Rinpoche's sister, who spent some time at KTD, and I didn't have the opportunity to meet her, but apparently she chanted Om Mani Padme Hum all the time, all the time, all the time, and would even go up to people if they were just idly talking and tell, I don't think she spoke much English, tell them to stop what they were doing and chant. So, make your time useful. Chant Om Mani Padme Hum. So it really is a central part of Tibetan culture and practice. And that all started with the second Karmapa. So now we get into some of the more political and historical parts that get really fascinating with the second Karmapa. Around 1235, the Mongols invaded China. And Tibet had relative peace for a few years during this time until the grandson of Genghis Khan invaded the Tibetan plateau and reached the heart of central Tibet. At this time, there was no centralized power, no central government in Tibet, and there was no military. There were feudal lords who had some warriors, but that's about it. And so they quickly realized that these invading Mongols, that they were totally outnumbered and outmatched and vulnerable. And the invading Mongols didn't hesitate to burn down monasteries and villages and murder monks and nuns and village people. So the leaders decided to negotiate with this grandson of Genghis Khan. His name was Godan. And paradoxically, after he took over the whole region, he wanted to learn Buddhism and wanted his people to learn Buddhism. So he sent emissaries to find a master of incontestable knowledge worthy of undertaking the mission of spreading the Dharma to his people. So the teacher that went to see him was the head of the Sakya lineage, the Sakya Pandita. And in 1244, he sent for him and demanded that he appear before him. And the Sakya had no choice but to obey, but it did take him 3 years to get there, because all along the way, whenever someone asked him to teach, he would stop and give teachings and blessings and initiations and the whole bit. So he took his time. But when he got there, the Godan was very pleased that he had come, and actually gave the Sakya leader political power in Tibet, made him the political leader of central Tibet. And this relationship between the Sakya Pandita and the Khan were the beginning of the close ties between Tibet and Mongolia. There was a mutual exchange in which the Mongolian leaders would guarantee the military security for Tibet, and in exchange, Tibet would give the Mongolians their Buddhist teachings. And so neither party dominated the other. Another grandson, a grandson of Genghis Khan, and of course you've heard of Genghis Khan, but he's not in this story. He was a little bit before this, but another grandson was named Kublai Khan. Now, this is the one you may have heard of in English class. Maybe in history, I didn't. But in English, there's a famous poem by Samuel Coleraine, And it starts out, in Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alf the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea. And I don't even know the meaning of the poem, but I think it was an opiate trip that Samuel Coleraine made, because I believe he was famous for that. So, but anyway, the name Kublai Khan may ring a bell for some. So he was governor of some of the provinces and was greatly interested in the philosophies of Buddhism. And he had heard of the second Karmapa. He had heard of Karmapakshi. So he invited him to come to his residence, which he did. And Kublai Khan gave him his complete attention, showered him with gifts, and Karmapakshi had developed a reputation for having great miraculous powers. And this greatly impressed Kublai Khan. As I'm sure you can understand, a leader who's leading the Mongolian Empire, he's going to have a thing for power, right? He's been raised with power. So immediately that's what he is impressed with Karmapakshi. And so he was fascinated by that, and he asked the Karmapa to display these powers before the Mongol religious heads. So he did. And Kublai Khan was so happy at this elevated prestige that he wanted to keep the Karmapa permanently near him. But Karmapakshi didn't want to become involved in all the court intrigue, so he left. And Kublai Khan was not happy by his leaving. Now, it actually proved wise, because after he left, the Kublai Khan was overthrown by his brother, Monga. And Monga Khan wished to receive the Karmapa, so Karmapa went back and saw Monga Khan. And again, as he traveled back, he'd settled political disputes all along the way, as he always did. And when he arrived, he was received with great fanfare and respect. Monga Khan freed all prisoners and abolished the death penalty at the Karmapa's wish. Karmapakshi produced many miracles during his stay and widely disseminated the teachings, initiations, and readings of sacred text. History presents Monga Khan as a bloodthirsty tyrant before his meeting with the Karmapa, which proved to be a decisive meeting that made him become one of the most remarkable rulers in Mongol history. A profound relationship based on mutual respect was created between the Khan and the Karmapa, and the Khan became one of Karmapa's faithful disciples. I got to thinking about this in context of today, and we're in a turbulent time politically in this country, and it's often easy to feel helpless in the face of it. And it's often easy to wonder if these practices we do for the benefit of beings are actually benefiting beings, if you're actually doing something that will pay off. Now, the spiritual path really is taking the long view, and it's not an instant panacea for all of our social and political strife. But as we can see in the example of Karmapakshi, realization has great power, and true realized masters can absolutely make a difference. And then as we're starting out, as we change our behavior, as we change our thoughts and develop our compassion, we're starting that ball rolling, and it can make a small difference in our own lives and in those around us, and then bigger and bigger. And actually, ultimately, it can have dramatic effects, as we see here, in which the head of our lineage was able to influence and change a bloodthirsty tyrant. So Karmapa made Monga Khan promise to equitably protect all Buddhist lineages. And the Karmapa and the Khan traveled together throughout the Mongol Empire, where the Karmapa gave teachings and met with representatives of different religious factions of the time. And then the Karmapa chose to return to Tibet again. Now, Monga Khan would have preferred to keep Karmapakshi with him, but he wasn't angry at him like Kublai Khan was. He respected his wishes. And so he gave him the official documents necessary for him to travel freely throughout the empire. Then, while he was traveling back, he learned that Monga Khan had died. And there was a power struggle, and first Monga Khan's son, and then Kublai Khan actually came to power. Kublai Khan displaced Monga Khan's son. So the Karmapa sensed imminent danger because he knew Kublai Khan was still angry at him. And indeed, Kublai Khan had not forgotten that Karmapakshi left against his wishes. And so he sent soldiers to find the Karmapa and assassinate him. And they did find him, and they arrested him. And they inflicted the worst tortures on him. They burned him at the stake. They poisoned him. They threw him off a cliff, and nothing worked. And then they sent word back to Kublai Khan, and Kublai Khan said, well, exile him to the desert. He'll never be able to survive that. So the Karmapakshi spent his time in the desert writing spiritual texts. And when that didn't kill him either, Kublai Khan said, okay, we're dealing with an exceptional master here. And so he begged forgiveness and brought Karmapa back to his court. And Karmapa went and forgave Karmapakshi. And he actually offered him a bunch of gold and to stay in his court. And Karmapakshi refused the gold but agreed to stay. And he bestowed new teachings on Kublai Khan and renewed their bond. I got to thinking about this in my own life, about if you've ever felt wronged by someone or felt like you should forgive someone but find it hard to do. Have they ever poisoned you, thrown you off a cliff, or burned you at the stake, or exiled you to a desert? Probably not. But Karmapakshi actually forgave all of this. So when Karmapakshi wanted to go back to Tibet, Kublai Khan acquiesced and gave him freedom and assurances that Karmapakshi could spread the teachings everywhere without fear. So now we get to the other figure you may have heard about in history. And it was during this time that Marco Polo actually visited the Mongol court. And Marco Polo makes references to Tibetan lamas who could perform miracles. And he talks about a festivity in which, in the great reception hall, the Kublai Khan's table was levitating several meters off the ground, and the goblets would present themselves in front of the guests by themselves. So anyway, that's actually in Marco Polo's writings. And I don't think he mentions which lamas it is by name, but given the time period, it very easily could have been the second Karmapa that he's talking about. So during his meditations, Karmapakshi had a vision at this time of Shakyamuni Buddha, who told him to construct a Buddha statue at Serpu Monastery. The protectors also appeared, promising their support. So Karmapakshi sent someone to Serpu to begin construction of the statue. And he spent 8 years on his return journey, during which time he stopped frequently to meditate in sacred spaces and to teach the locals. And in one instance, he succeeded in arresting the ravages of an epidemic through specific rituals dedicated to Medicine Buddha. And we, by the way, have Medicine Buddha practiced here weekly as well. All along his journey, he redistributed property he had received from patrons and disciples so that dilapidated monasteries could be reconstructed. He also supported monks, nuns, and the needy, and all those who sought his generosity. When he returned, he oversaw the final stages of construction of the statue. It was almost 20 meters tall and composed entirely of copper and gold. And it was called the Great Sage Ornament of the World. Once completed, relics of the historical Buddha and his disciples were placed inside. Unfortunately, it leaned to the left. So when the Karmapa noticed this, he sat down in meditative posture and he tilted his body the same way. And as he meditated, he slowly sat up. And there was a sound of metal grinding, and the statue also sat up at the same time and then remained upright. And of course, this astonished the monks who were in attendance. For the next 700 years, that statue was an object of profound devotion for the faithful. In the 1960s, during the destruction of Tsurpu Monastery, it was actually blown up by the Chinese army. And for many years, minuscule fragments were found all around on the ground, some of which were fragments of the relics. And in 1997, our current Karmapa erected a new statue identical to the previous one. And the current Karmapa spent a lot of time at Tsurpu Monastery before he escaped to India. In 99-2000, he escaped over the turn of the millennium. That week, basically, he spent escaping to India. Even higher above Tsurpu Monastery is when he was 70, he decided to stop traveling and stay at Tsurpu. And he spent time at a hermitage where he used to meditate. And it later became a small center where monks could do their three-year retreat. Even higher than that is a cave where he retreated to meditate in absolute darkness and isolation. It was said that during the time he was in Mongolia, there was a Karmapakshi statue that they placed in that cave, and that it would talk. So, Karmapakshi said that every being that came to Tsurpu or drank its water would establish a specific karmic link, allowing him or her to avoid rebirth in the lower realms and to approach enlightenment. He announced that in the future, foreigners who visited Tsurpu or simply heard its name would develop great respect for the site. So that's us now. Throughout his life, Karmapakshi received visions of numerous Buddhas, masters, yidams, and protectors who guided him in important decisions. And in one, the Buddha Vajradhara appeared to him radiating blue light, surrounded by numerous yidams. They prophesied that an endless succession of greatly realized masters would appear in his lineage. And he also saw Milarepa, who predicted his lineage would develop without any obstacles. And Gampopa appeared to him and prophesied that numerous monasteries would be established throughout the world. As an aside, the Buddha Vajradhara, also known as the primordial Buddha, or the origin of our lineage. Our main statue is in our new building will be the Buddha Vajradhara, and it's pretty big, and we have pictures of it, so very exciting. Shortly before his death, the Karmapa entrusted the teachings to a great master and announced details about his next reincarnation, just as the first Karmapa had done. He died at the age of 80, which is a surprisingly advanced age for that time, and as with the first Karmapa, his disciples were instructed not to touch his body for 7 days. And then when they and his body remained in meditation posture during that time. When he was cremated, the monks discovered relics among his ashes, which were later encased in stupas. And here's where I say that he established or renovated more than 8,000 monasteries, although in later centuries some of these were destroyed by invading Mongols or converted to other lineages. Now, getting away a little bit from the history, I'm sure we have some Nundro practitioners here today. Once you've established a daily practice and worked with Lama Kathy on some of our other practices, you and Lama Kathy may together decide that you want to start on the foundational practices that lead to the Mahamudra practices. These foundation practices are a series of four practices: refuge and bodhicitta, Vajrasattva, mandala offering, and guru yoga. And you do each one of these more than 100,000 times, each one of these practices more than 100,000 times. So there's a mantra or there's something in each of these practices that you count. And so it takes months in a retreat setting, it takes years outside of a retreat setting to finish them. But once you're done with all these four practices, you often meet in around here with Kempo Karthur Rinpoche, and he will often give you a life practice. And very commonly, that life practice is the Karmapakshi practice. And I have not finished my Nundro, so I don't know much about that practice, but I have heard that it's full of Mahamudra practice, and it does come with an empowerment. In 2015, His Holiness the 17th Karmapa was at our monastery in upstate New York, and in Kingston, New York, he gave the Karmapakshi empowerment. Now, I was fortunate enough to be there and receive the Karmapakshi empowerment. But before the empowerment itself, he talked about the history that we've covered today. He talked about Kublai Khan trying to assassinate Karmapakshi and all the things he tried. He talked about Marco Polo. He talked about exactly what we've talked about today in a much shorter form prior to giving the empowerment. But it was very meaningful, but it was also very interesting to hear the 17th Karmapa talk about the history of the second Karmapa. So, quite a fascinating thing. That's about it for time for my part, but I can open it up for questions on anything. I know this is kind of a different kind of talk than what we usually have here because there's so many historical things, but there are so many nuggets in Karmapakshi's life that to me are fascinating and inspiring. We'll open up the microphone. If anyone has any questions about anything, feel free. Studying these great masters, it's really fascinating to look at Lama Kathy says, let me start a little further back. Lama Kathy says, realization changes a person. It changes a being. And with a realized master like this, the connection that you can create to that master can actually end up being a connection in which the master bestows blessings if you're open to receive them. Lama Kathy says it's like having a radio tower always broadcasting. That master is always broadcasting blessings, and if we choose to tune in, then we can be recipients of that. And she said it's like a hook in a ring. If you are open, if you have respect for the teachings, and if you open yourself to these teachings, then you actually can make that connection with these masters. And Karmapakshi has said that anyone who came in contact with him, anyone who had that link with him, anyone who had a link with some of the monasteries he created and things like that, have a link with Karmapakshi. And similarly with His Holiness the 17th Karmapa. And you don't have to have seen him in person, although he's much more free to travel now than he ever has been. And so the opportunities to see him teach, I'm sure, will be even more and more. But you can see videos online. We have pictures on our shrine. And just by coming here, which is one of his centers, you have that connection with him. And that, to me, is the thing that I took away the most from studying this, is how improbable it is that we here in Columbus, Ohio, could end up with this connection with this master and receive these blessings. So that for me is what I've taken away. Ron, did you have something to add or a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that when you were mentioning six yogas in Europa, besides Tummo, I know another one is the yoga of dream and sleep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think you could look it up online, the six yogas in Europa.
Yeah, I'm sure you can. And and I know people often express interest in those because they are fascinating. Dream yoga is what, or dream and sleep yoga is what Ron's talking about. And basically, I believe the point of that practice is that your mind in sleep, if you can actually be lucid during your dreams, you aren't as constrained by some of the physical limitations that we have in what you can do in a dream mentally. And also that you can make your time spent sleeping and dreaming actual practice time rather than just kind of lost time that our bodies need. So it's a fascinating practice, but one that, like I said, I don't know a lot of instances of our teachers teaching it outside of a 3-year retreat setting. Go ahead.
I was going to say that I know, at least in the case of dream and sleep yoga, there is a lay practitioner named Andrew Holacek who's mm-hmm. written a book about it. There's a few others as mm-hmm. well. So at least to some extent, it's, I know, considered acceptable to like practice these things. Like I work with lucid dreaming, for example, and mm-hmm. I don't have specific empowerments, but it's just like, by bringing lucidity to your sleep, it's kind of just like extending mindfulness practice almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know some of this is taught outside of it. For myself, I'm very careful to make sure that when I work with a teacher on teachings, that I'm working with, that when I work with Lama Kathy, for example, on what my practice should be, I run things past her. Obviously, I've read widely, studied widely. I've seen some of these things and other teachings and thought about them, things like that, talked to Lama Kathy about them. And in some cases, she says, sure, we have that in our lineage. Let's go ahead and get you hooked up with that. Or in other cases, it's another thing. I tell you, the longer I've been in contact with these teachings, the more important the basics become to me. And that's quite honestly true. Lama Kathy likes to say that when we come to these teachings, we bring all of our neuroticisms with us to these teachings. And I've said in the past, mine is that ambition. I want the greatest teachings, the highest teachings, the coolest teachings, the coolest sounding teachings, right? And it's often tempted to go down to chase a lot of things like that, and realize that if you're not spending time developing your compassion, and if you're not spending your time rooting yourself in refuge and some of these things, then you really can become unmoored. That's not to discourage you from doing any practice, because these practices are all valuable. And actually, it's said that I think a couple weeks ago when I taught, last month, Thaisi Thu Rinpoche said that it's always said that the Buddha taught 84,000 teachings, but then because we all personalize them, the number of teachings there are is actually 84,000 times the number of people there are, or the number of beings there are. So really, it's all very personalized, and certain teachings may work for some and not so much for others. But I would say it's very helpful. For me, I spent a lot of time on my journey before I really came in contact with a teacher I could work with on my practice. I spent a lot of time kind of going this way and that way and this way and that way. And the progress I made before that time versus when I worked with Lama Kathy, there's just no difference. There's no way to compare. It's night and day between the two. And so I highly recommend that personalized approach with Lama Kathy. And it's one of the greatest benefits that our center really has to offer. It's fantastic that we can come here and have qualified teachers work with us individually on what will be best for our practice. And so I encourage you to take advantage of that. Yes?
Very grateful that the center is here. And I want to say that I went to a lineage talk by someone here, and the picture of the Karmapa really felt like he was looking at me.
Mm.
It really had that quality of grabbing you.
Mm-hmm.
So grateful for that.
Thank you.
Secondly, wanted to ask, how did you spell Godong?
Oh, the one of the earlier Khans,
yes.
Rulers of Mongolia. It's Godan is okay. The way it was in the book. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's easy to get stuck in the weeds of the history, but I thought it was fascinating. I think it's so interesting how this all came about, and we have an example today of His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. He's a Nobel Prize winner. He's met with heads of countless countries. He's done so much that still very active in a very political sense, but very authentic to who he is and to who his teachings are. And so we still have an example of what it's like to take this realization into the world, even at the highest levels of power. And I find that fascinating, but thank you.
Mm-hmm. I guess that stirs another question in that it's lovely to hear the lineage, and it helps quell some of my own doubts that mm-hmm. of this authenticity, because in the West, we're not accustomed to thinking of lineage.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of cowboys and
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
cowgirls.
Mm-hmm.
And want to go our own way.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I something I often find difficult is when, say, family members or people who are dedicated to a different religion challenge me, I can't recite why this is authentic.
Mm-hmm.
I can't debate that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel under attack in a way.
Sure.
And
sure.
Because this is so odd to Western soil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. But I think it's one of I agree completely with what you're saying. On the one hand, lineage is difficult to get your mind around. I think if anyone came from a Catholic background, they have a very similar concept in Catholicism with the I forget what it's called, the something of the saints. But anyway, the idea that this has been passed down. I did not have a Catholic background, so this was very different to me. But at the same time, there are so many teachings out there. It is fascinating to know that here we have a center that was established as part of this lineage that goes back to the Indian sages, and then that goes back to the time of the Buddha. And they have texts and they have these histories to actually connect that whole lineage back. If you ever get a chance to visit KTD and listen to teachings by Kimpo Karcha Rinpoche and things like that, it gives you a sense of the vastness and the connection to that lineage that we have. And the depth of what's backing these teachings, and I'm just passing them along, obviously, but what's behind this is centuries and centuries of monastics in monasteries, in caves, practicing and realizing through these teachings. And it's humbling to know that we can receive these and practice in the same way. So, thank you. Yes, Julie.
Mm-hmm. I've always been fascinated by a rupa that's on the shrine, mm-hmm. Rupashya's mudra, and
mm-hmm.
their mudra miracles, or do you know about?
I have no idea, and the book didn't say it, but that's a good question. So this is Karmapakshi right here, and he's holding in one hand, he's holding the dorje up high, and then in the other hand, he's holding the purba, which is a ritual knife and used in certain... Oh, Eric knows. Okay, great. Perfect.
Well, I think I know.
Okay.
Probably I know this much of what's that big.
Right.
So. First of all, thank you. That was mm-hmm. wonderful. I want to tie his posture together with something else.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Nundro.
Mm-hmm.
Buddhism doesn't have a lot of belief, but it's got a lot of method.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of Karmapakshi was he put up with a lot.
Mm.
Like we put up with a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because he walked the path, he gained some ability to work with difficult times.
Mm.
And he had them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the main example. The issue about getting one practice or another isn't like we think of it like, oh, I want to cook this recipe, I make a cookbook, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's more like you have realization, you have creative moment of knowing how to work with whatever's coming at you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate Karmapakshi's practice in that he showed me it was possible for a human being to work with whatever comes.
Mm. Mm.
The question always arose for the Karmapas, okay, how do we get there? The ninth Karmapa finally wrote down what we now call Nundro practice.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if you want to get there, do this. And that's why I think you're exactly right. We've got something to work on. It takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
And but the benefits or the results are worthwhile and they're demonstrated. The problem with going after stuff that just looks like something we want is it's being co-opted by our self-cherishing. It's what we want. I want this. And you can learn anything, and you can be selfish about anything, including the highest teachings. You see that, unfortunately, in some practitioners. The best thing to learn is what you said, which is refuge in bodhicitta. Taking refuge in the Buddha instead of your own self-cherishing or ego trip, and cultivating all the realization and skills of bodhicitta. So what Karmapakshi is doing there with that background is, with the purba he's pinning down, it looks like a stake, right? He's pinning down self-cherishing, pinning it to the ground. It didn't really destroy it, because we all have selves as long as we have bodies, but rounding it, making it real, right? And also making it so it's not able to act. And what he's doing with the Vajra is like demonstrating the power of enlightened mind. Because that Vajra represents the enlightened activity, okay? So he's subduing, and then he's demonstrating realization. So every time you look at that, when you're doing Karmapakshi practice eventually, that practice takes you through all the steps you need to train your mind in subduing self-cherishing and adopting enlightened activity. So we get to become Karmapa. That's the whole idea, Anyway.
Very beautiful.
The 17th just recently said, by the way, everybody's Karmapa. Karmapa means activity of the Buddha. We're just at different stages of being able to do this. You know, fully realized beings are fully capable of doing that.
Thank you. Excellent. Now, that reminds me, and we've gone over time, but it reminds me of, I don't even remember who the master was, but there was some master in Tibet that went to a statue and of the Buddha or a Buddha or whatever. And I'm telling this story badly because I don't remember the details, but basically he stood before him and said, "The only difference between me and you is that I was lazy when you were not." In other words, you've done the work, you've gotten there, I'm still on the way. And that's probably what Karmapa, we're just at different stages. In the past, we've been lazy when he wasn't, and now we recognize that, so now it's our time to work. So, excellent, thank you. Well, thank you everyone for being here today. And let's dedicate the merit of listening to these stories of the masters of our lineage and Karmapa. And may we follow in the example of Karmapakshi in subduing our self-cherishing and facing whatever comes and working tirelessly to wake up to attain the power of enlightenment. We dedicate the merit of this activity and all future virtuous activities that all beings may find ultimate relief from suffering. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.